Okay, hear me out now. If one bond market story is good, two is better, right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 4th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to start today where we started yesterday, except different. Matt Levin, you might remember, ran us through the challenges that rising bond yields pose for the federal government and for consumers. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note topped out yesterday at a bit more than 4.8%. It is a little lower today, but nonetheless, we've still got some questions we need answered. So we got Sudeep Reddy from Politico on the phone to talk things over. Sudeep, it's good to have you back on a non-Friday.
Hey, Kai. Happy non-Friday.
Happy non-Friday. So a couple of things. Number one, bond rates, specifically the 10-year, has been rising for, you know, a little while now, as one would expect with Jay Powell doing what Jay Powell is doing. The week, last 10 days-ish or so, they have really started to shoot up. And my question is, why? What's going on that we need to be aware of?
So first of all, a lot of this is stuff that we expect to happen. We shouldn't be that surprised that bond yields rise when there's tighter policy in this regard. I think most people are just surprised by the pace at which things are moving. When things happen like this out of control, it's not necessarily out of control yet, but when you get that feeling that there's a relentless rise in something like the cost of borrowing, mm-hmm. it makes people very nervous, and it should make people very nervous, just like the rising price of oil makes people nervous and all sorts of other things. But it's we've been in a very weird, wild, wacky couple of years from mm-hmm. ultra low rates, from the Fed hitting the gas hard that's where they are right now. Mm-hmm. And they were hitting the accelerator hard before. They've gone from hitting the gas to hitting the brakes. So the fact that they've done this, and it's just hard for everybody to process that kind of rapid change.
Okay. You mentioned the wild, crazy couple of years we've had, and we've talked about that a lot, both on Fridays and elsewhere on the show. It has long been said that if you want to know where the economy is going, look at the bond market. My question, though, is with the economy as befuddled as it's and befuddling as it's been the last 3 years, is maybe the bond market wrong?
Oh, dangerous words. Dangerous words. You want to be careful when you say that.
We like to live on the edge here at Marketplace.
Yeah. Look, usually when the Fed raises rates, the economy tends to go into a recession. There's the legendary soft landing that we all keep talking about. Right. It did happen in 94 and 95, kind of once. There are a few others that you could call softish, but that is generally the bond market is usually right about this. What's been weird this time is that the bond market had been guessing that we were going to get the recession, right, and then suddenly has just decided over the summer, maybe we're not getting the recession. And that's what's actually gotten very confusing. The great irony of it all is that these things tend to be confusing in the worst possible moment. Mm-hmm. And then it all becomes very obvious after the fact. Think back to late 2019, and then it was very obvious mm-hmm. in 2020 what was happening. Think of this in 2007. It was very obvious in 2008 what was happening. That doesn't mean will be obvious, but that's how these things tend to resolve themselves. And people are just very confused right now and wondering whether that's going to actually be obvious in the coming months, and don't want to get offsides in that scenario.
Right. I won't hold you to this, but do you think what's going on now in the bond market and the fact that interest rates are going to be higher for longer than a lot of people had thought, do you think that puts the whole soft landing thing at risk?
The soft landing dream was always a dream. It was a hope. It was a narrow path. It was the kind of thing that we all have to want. You have to hope that it will happen, and it has happened before. It's just very hard to pull off, and we just all have to recognize that everything post-COVID has been just extremely funky in this economy. The scale of the free money during COVID, the high savings rates, the fact that we've had labor shortage, going to labor hoarding by a lot of companies, this pivot from hitting the gas, hitting the brakes, all of it's quite unusual. And so it's possible that maybe the soft landing is going to come through, and maybe that it's not like it always has been before. But that's what we're all wondering in this moment.
All right, you got 30 seconds to answer this, because otherwise we're going to run out of time at the bottom of the show. So you know how a recession's been 6 months away now for a year and a half? It sort of sounds like you're saying that a soft landing is 6 months away, but it's going to take a year and a half for us to figure it out.
That is exactly right. Jay Powell will not be able to tell you in the coming months whether a soft landing has been achieved, and that's the greatest nightmare for him.
Sudeep Reddy at Politico, raining on our parade on a Wednesday. Thanks, Sudeep.
Thanks, Kai.
See ya. Wall Street today, calmer, I think, is the word. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A stipulation to set up this next piece. Electric vehicles are the future of vehicles. Self-driving? Sure, maybe. Semi-autonomous? Fine, yes, whatever. But they are going to be electric. Cars, light trucks, big semis, all of them. So the global rules of the road, if you will, on how those EVs are made and sold, again, globally, rules that are being set right now are going to matter long term. Case in point, today the European Union launched an investigation into Chinese state subsidies for its EV makers, and the EU is going to consider some kinds of penalties to even the playing field. Europe is eager to avoid the fate that befell its solar industry a decade ago, which was mostly wiped off the continent by low-cost Chinese competition. And as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, the EU is walking a very fine line in protecting its EV makers, and the United States is watching.
Europe says Chinese electric vehicle makers benefited from unfair subsidies. China says, no, we're just really competitive. So who's right?
There's elements of truth in both of these stories.
Michael Davidson is assistant professor at the University of California, San Diego. Chinese electric car companies are extremely innovative by all accounts. Chinese EV maker BYD is backed by Warren Buffett and is within a hair of overtaking Tesla in global sales.
China's EV supply chain has become very competitive and vertically integrated.
Vertically integrated, meaning the same company makes the car and its parts, like the battery.
Something that Western manufacturers have struggled to do, with the exception perhaps of Tesla.
Ilaria Mazzocco is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. On the other hand, China's government at multiple levels has offered significant subsidies for many years, some that are used even in the U.S., like rewarding consumers and tax breaks, and others that Europe believes go beyond what's fair.
Manufacturers benefit from direct grants, but also cheap credit. Also, there are so-called government guidance funds, which essentially are government private equity.
A Nikkei Asia analysis shows subsidies valued in the billions of U.S. dollars accelerated for many firms this year. Government support goes back decades.
The Chinese government decided we're going to invest in these things. The United States and European Union could have done the exact same thing, but they chose to ignore it.
Tu Li is managing director at Sino Auto Insights. The U.S. is insulated from Chinese EVs due to existing tariffs, but as Chinese cars get more competitive, that insulation might wear thin. Li says Europe also finds itself internally divided on how much of a trade fight to pick with China.
It's the French versus the Germans, because companies like Renault, Citroën, Peugeot, they effectively have no presence in China.
German companies do and have a lot more to lose from a trade fight. Europe is also trying to meet climate goals, so it needs more electric vehicles. The EU has 12 months under the law to thread those needles. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Bloomberg and the good people at the Harris Poll went out into the field in August asking people about housing. Among the findings, about 45% of people in this economy, 18 to 29, are living with family, the highest that percentage has been since the 1940s. And if you've been following the housing news, that is probably not a surprise. Rents are high, rates are high, inventories are low. And as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports, Those who are looking to live on their own are running into a lot of competition, too.
Looking for an apartment these days can feel like a full-time job, one that's mostly remote.
So here we have Craigslist for Koreatown. Here we have Zillow. Padmapper is one that I actually have been seeing a lot of stuff.
Ben Lubin is giving me a glimpse into what his days are like right now, trying to find somewhere to live in Los Angeles.
Basically, like, I have probably like at least 10 separate tabs open that I am combing through. Feels like kind of the first thing I do when I wake up. I check all the listings.
And then he checks them again and again, all day, every day. Lubin is 30 and works in film, and this is his first time looking for an apartment. He moved back in with his mom after college in 2015 to save money. And with the pandemic, he's stayed longer than he planned. Now that he is ready to move, he's finding there's not that much out there in the $2,500 range.
It is hard to find a place that is in my budget that there is not a massive glaring red flag with.
He's toured probably 20 places in the last couple months. The two he's been most interested in, he lost out on. One because he couldn't check his email for a few hours, and another because it turned out the agent didn't know the landlord had already offered the apartment to someone else. It's a rough time to be looking for a place to live, especially if you don't have a big budget. At 22, Anna Mayo found that when she started looking for a studio apartment in Duluth, Minnesota, where she grew up and graduated from college this spring.
I toured a lot of places, and like one of them was awesome. I was the first person there. I put money down.
She thought she had it, but then the landlord got back to her.
And then he said, oh, somebody with better credit, I'm going to rent to them. They came after you, but, you know, they can pick and choose like that, unfortunately. So
eventually she got lucky. Her mom came across an old ad a landlord hadn't realized was still up. And it turned out he had a studio that was about to open.
So the timing was perfect. And I mean, he said to me, too, like, he'll put a studio apartment up and it's gone in, like, a day.
Moving into her own place for $700 a month, Mayo almost felt like she'd won the lottery. In New York City, where the average rent on a studio is now over $3,400, Naosha Gregg is hoping to luck into a similar kind of situation. She's 24 and graduated from college in May 2020.
When the world was falling apart, so that was fun.
Gregg lived at home for college to avoid taking out student loans and then stayed to save up money to move out. By the end of last year, she felt like she had enough. Then she started looking.
I found a nice apartment and the rent was really, really great. It was like $1,100 and I was like, this is amazing. But then when I saw the broker's fee on top of first month's, last month's and security, I'm like, that is almost $7,000 just to get the keys.
It was too much. She couldn't do it. And that was one of the only decent places she's been able to find in months of searching that's in her price range of $1,200 to $1,400. Mostly when she's sitting on her computer scrolling Zillow, like now, the only things that come up in Brooklyn are not places she'd want to live.
This one's pretty interesting. It's a studio for $1,200, which is really great. It's cheap because of the location. There's no train. You have to take a bus to a train. It's a very long commute.
Which might be okay if everything else was great. But then she clicks through and realizes it's a basement with one tiny window in the entire apartment. And she also sees that to qualify, she'd need a credit score of 700, which she doesn't have.
Yeah, so right now I've paused my search.
And she's reassessing what's realistic.
I've even been considering moving out of New York, which is really sad because I was born and raised here. Everything I know is here, from my friends, my family, my hair salon, my grocery store, my doctors.
But she's not quite ready to make that call yet. She's hoping that looking in the winter might be a little easier and that, like Anna Mayo in Duluth, she'll eventually find a local landlord who will give a native New Yorker just starting out a chance. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Should you be optimizing your job around your surfing, or should you do the opposite way around?
I know what I'd say. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 127 points today, 0.4%, 33,129. The NASDAQ up 176 points, about 1.3%, 13,236. The S&P 500 gained 34 points, 0.8%. 42 and 63 there. Several energy stocks moved lower as oil prices fell. ExxonMobil down 3.7%. Marathon Petroleum slipped 3.75%. Falling oil prices usually help cruise line stocks. Royal Caribbean or Royal Caribbean, take your pick, sailed up 3%. Norwegian Cruise Line grew 3.8%. Carnival jumped 2.75%. Bond prices, of which Sudeep and I were speaking, prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note, 4.73%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? Don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. There's a group called the Institute for Supply Management, which is all about supply and managing it. Everything supply, really. Inventories, logistics, purchasing, just everything. And it's not just focused on goods either, the ISM isn't. They keep an eye on the services economy as well, which I mentioned because the ISM told us this morning that the services sector in this economy grew last month for the 9th month in a row, but it grew more slowly than it had been growing. Accommodation and food services contributed to that slowdown. That category actually fell in September. So we asked Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall to check in with people who are trying to run restaurants in this economy.
The post-pandemic heyday is over for Sean Huggard, who owns two oyster bars in Denver. Last year, he saw demand for luxury seafood spike. But this year?
We finished the month of September 10% down.
He's seeing more traffic through the door, but people are spending less.
It might be I traded down from a $50 piece of Chilean sea bass to a $27 fish and chips.
That trade down is also happening at lower price points, says Stephanie Schimp, who runs a chain of diners in the Twin Cities for the Blue Plate Restaurant Company.
Less steaks and fresh fish, center of the plate type items, more sandwiches, more handheld, more I'll get the burger instead of the steak.
In Austin, Texas, sales dipped in September at Kirby Lane Cafe's 10 locations. Mason Ayer is CEO.
Top line numbers are not running as strong as they were through June, July, and August.
He's expecting a stronger fall, in part thanks to an upcoming music festival. But he doesn't think sales volumes will ever return to pre-pandemic numbers.
We don't operate 24 hours a day any longer because there's simply not demand past about 10 o'clock at night.
Restaurants have cut whole days of operation in Wisconsin. Susan Quam is VP of the state's Restaurant Association.
A lot of operators that were, you know, open 7 days a week, you know, in 2019 are now probably closed 2 days a week.
She says the reduced hours have helped stabilize staffing issues. Many employees are sticking around because they actually get 2 days off. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
Quantum dots is the scientific phrase of the day for which the Nobel Prize in Chemistry was awarded this morning. Nanoparticles, they are, with uses in television displays and medicine and some LED lighting, too, which is where we come in. The global market for LED illumination last year was around $71 billion. That's from Grandview Research, which also says the market is going to grow better than 10% a year through the end of the decade. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes is on LED duty today.
At Poplar Place Hardware in Dundalk, Maryland, owner Brandon Akins has a display of different kinds of LED bulbs all lit up.
Because it's new to people. They come in, they're like, well, what is an LED? What is a lead bulb, they'll call them.
The four bulbs range in color from a soft white to one that looks like a vintage Edison bulb.
and I'll turn it on and be like, oh, wow, you know.
LEDs are most of his light bulb inventory now, and he says they are more expensive than incandescent bulbs, about double the price.
But if they last 10 times as long and you have to change them a lot fewer times, then they pay for themselves in the long run.
LEDs use about 10% of the energy that incandescents do, and Aikens notes incandescents are being phased out. He calls LEDs a huge improvement over compact fluorescent lights, those ones with the twisty shape. They're energy efficient, but can kind of make you look washed out. Scientist and energy consultant Morgan Pattison calls LEDs a once-in-a-century disruptor.
I think the disruption is equivalent to the candle to incandescent light.
Pattison says almost all new lighting products sold in the U.S. are LEDs, and the government rebates have helped with customer adoption. But there's cost savings for the climate, too. Lighting is a big contributor to carbon emissions and would be even bigger without LEDs, says Jay Coe of the Lightsmith Group, a climate-focused private equity firm. He points out that LEDs only caught on once they became a better product.
The lesson there, I think, really is if we're going to address climate change, the technology has to not just be better for the planet and more efficient for energy usage. It also has to be a better experience.
Coe says that's why the LED industry is taking off and notes sustainable products will only be sustainable if people want to keep buying them. In Dundalk, Maryland, I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
You know the saying, there's an app for that? Cars and Uber, delivery and Instacart and a bunch of others. Also, surfing. I read in The Atlantic the other day about such an app and its website that'll track and forecast waves and winds and whatnot, but not without controversy. Caroline Mims-Nice wrote the aforementioned story. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell me how a technology reporter for The Atlantic got interested in surf and technology.
So I'm a beginner surfer here in Los Angeles.
How's it going?
You know, it's going. It's slow, but better than I thought
right,
it would
good,
be.
Good, good. Anyway, so you're a beginning surfer and?
Beginner surfer, and I had just been fascinated about how quickly my life started to revolve around this website called Surfline. And my weekends and all of my schedule basically is me planning to go out and surf based on when this website tells me that it's ideal to.
So I have it up in the studio, but I'm going to let you give the expert's description. What can this website do for me should I be a surfer? Which, to be clear, I am not.
So Surfline is at its core a wave forecasting website. They have 1,000 cameras. Millions of people use it to plan where and when to go out. So just before we started talking, I looked up Malibu. Looks like it's a cruddy couple of days in Malibu.
Cruddy. That's a very surfer term, a cruddy couple of days.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's ideal surfing conditions over there right now. In addition to doing these forecasts, they partner with the World's Surf League in order to decide when professional contests are held. They blog about upcoming swells and recent good waves that people have caught. So it's sort of a full-scale media company. And I found that surfers have a love-hate relationship with it.
All right, so we'll get to the love-hate thing in a second, but I do want to point out here the data, right? Because this is kind of a data play. It tells you what the onshore winds are, and you can click and, you know, pay a subscription fee to get live wind. It tells you with a 2-millimeter wetsuit, it's 66 degrees Fahrenheit, so that's what you should wear. It tells you it's a dropping tide, 2.5-foot waves, 7-foot swells, winds out of the west at 260 degrees. So, yeah, winds out of the west. Anyway.
And you've got the color codes. I feel like that's very
important.
Oh, there
are the color codes.
You know, it'll tell you it'll be yellow or orange if it's bad to go out, and you'll get that green light if it's good.
Okay, so let's get to the whole love-hate thing.
Yes. Pretty much since Surfline has existed, it's been polarizing. I think that this really gets at a question of the spirit of the sport. Mm-hmm. Is surfing about everyone being able to get out in the water? Is this a cheat code to only go when it's really ideal? A lot of surfing used to be related to counterculture as well.
Yeah.
Should you be optimizing your job around your surfing, or should you do the opposite way around?
Right. So let me paraphrase. Has surfing sold out to the man, right?
Oh, that's a tough question.
I know. What do you think? You wrote the piece. You're a surfer. You tell me.
So I certainly think, you know, we've seen surfing has become a lot more commercialized. There are more surfers. There was an increase of 1 million, according to one study, from 2009 to 2022. But, you know, I also like seeing people in the water, and it's a special experience. And I hope a lot of people get to share in that.
Caroline Mims-Nice, writing in The Atlantic about Surfline. Caroline, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Great. Thank you so much.
This final note on the way out today, automotive division. Saw this on Axios, data from Edmunds, the car people. Kind of goes back to what Sudeep and I were talking about. The average monthly payment on a new vehicle bought in the last 3 months was $736. That is $33 higher than a year ago. The average annual percentage rate on new vehicles that are financed was 7.4%. Again, this is the past 3 months. And the average borrower buying a new vehicle took out just over $40,000 in loans. All right, we got to go. Here is your moment, though, of economic context. A couple of quick energy nuggets. I alluded to this in the numbers. Crude oil today, both the U.S. and global benchmarks, down 5%. Of perhaps more interest to American drivers, gasoline futures down more than 6%. Remember the other day I talked about demand destruction? Yeah, this is that. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Justin Dueler, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.